This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. We recently learned that 500 million Yahoo users had their information stolen 2 years ago, and the Internal Revenue Service announced earlier this year that personal data from more than 700,000 taxpayer accounts have been compromised. It's estimated that half of American adults have had their personal information exposed, and the danger from hackers to both individuals and organizations is ever increasing. Joining us to talk about cybersecurity and what you can do to protect your personal information are Northern Kentucky University College of Informatics Associate Professor Dr. James Walden, Michael Picton, co-founder and vice president of Managed Detection and Response Services at Morphic, and software architect and developer Dave Hatter. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And James, Michael, and Dave, thanks so much for being here this afternoon.
Thanks for having us on the show.
I keep hearing about cases of things like what happened to Yahoo and what happened to the IRS, and it seems like hacking stories are always popping up in the news, James. How much is this a problem? Just how big a deal is this?
It's a huge problem, really. I'd say the half of everyone's identities being stolen is probably an underestimate.
Okay. A lot of people wouldn't even know, I would imagine, that they had had their identity stolen.
Right. The biggest limitation that criminals have in getting your money is not getting your information. It's being able to hire enough what they call money mules to monetize it and to use stolen credit cards, receive stolen goods, and so forth.
So just how concerned should I be and how worried should I be, Michael?
You got to assume that the internet's a bad neighborhood when you go out there and know that your information is going to be taken at some point. So you got to use common sense and look out for things like using different usernames and passwords everywhere that you go. It's one of those things. Some of the common sense things like having very complex passwords. You can use – there's a lot of tools out there like LastPass where you can – save your passwords, use it, and it's a very complex password. And you know, if someone takes it, it's going to be difficult to use. And other things that they can use is things like two-factor authentication. That's one of the things that we recommend everybody uses on your bank accounts and on your computer and on your different applications on your phone, because there's two different factors that they have to use. So if your credit, if your user credentials get stolen out of Yahoo or something like that, they may have the password, but they don't have that other factor of authentication.
Now, by that, do you mean like the identification questions that they ask you to list?
Yes, there's
that's a two-factor.
And there's other things that change. There's a number of different two-factor products you can use out there where, like for Gmail, they will send you a text to your phone and give you a code, and then you'll enter that code in along with your password. That way they know that it's you. So if you don't have your phone and you just have the password, you would not be able to get in.
I mean, so I should note that your email account is probably your most important account, maybe more so than your bank account. A lot of people think, well, they just get my email. But instead, what they get is that they'll go to your bank and eBay and Amazon, all the places you shop. They'll reset your passwords, and all those companies will send the reset password to your email account. And if they control your email account, they control all of your accounts then.
And I think an important point to add to that is if they can get into your email account, they can harvest all of this other information very easily.
Right.
So they can figure out who you bank with. So instead of sending you some sort of generic phishing account from a bank you don't bank with, you can now get much more targeted things. They can figure out where you bank, have the passwords resent to this email account that they now control. Yeah, that's a huge problem. I agree with everything that's been said here so far. Two-factor authentication is one relatively simple and effective way to cut some of this stuff down because, as Michael pointed out, you can't get logged in without the second piece of information that gets delivered to you through some other channel like a text or something.
You know, Dave, something I've noticed is that lately when I've been signing up for a new account and they ask me to create my my username and password, they're actually giving me a guide on there that tells me how strong or how weak that is. That seems like that's a new trend. That's developed.
Some sites have done it for a while, and there are sites out there like Microsoft's got one where you can test password strength. I would encourage folks, though, to remember that anything you do online, unless you are extremely certain of the credibility of whatever you're doing, just because some site says it will test your password for you doesn't mean it's not some sort of illegitimate thing. So, you know, if you're not paying with money, you're paying with data. People want your information. You can't just trust stuff. And Michael mentioned LastPass. There's all kinds of password manager programs out there. I would strongly recommend against just downloading any old thing you find for free because it might be malware. And some of those have been hacked as well. So unfortunately, there is no way to be 100% safe. You got to be really skeptical and unfortunately really cynical about all of this stuff and do your homework.
Yeah, and if you want to use two-factor auth, there's a website, twofactorauth.com, that lists all of the companies that provide two-factor authentication and gives links to their web pages on how to set it up. So that should make it a lot easier for you.
Yeah, and most banks and the email providers today, if you go into your settings in your account, it's very easy to set it up. You know, you'll go in and enable it. It takes about 2 minutes the next time you log in, and it goes a long way to really help you out.
Yeah, the drawback of having a really strong password, my wife is good at creating these, but she creates passwords that are so complicated that neither one of us can remember them, so we have to write them down somewhere. Is there any way around that?
I actually don't think writing down passwords is a bad idea, really. If you write them down, keep them in your wallet. You don't typically lose, you know, money from your wallet. You'll keep your passwords in your wallet, too.
Well, if you have your wallet stolen and your Social Security cards and your credit cards and everything in your wallet with your passwords, then they know what
you can lose more that way.
I would say I'm in between. I don't think it's a terrible idea, and I don't think it's a great idea, depending on the physical security of where it's written down. If it's on a piece of paper in your desk in your house, and you know you don't have anyone else that really has access to that other than like your wife or something, that's probably pretty safe. If you're taking it out with you somewhere, if other people have easy access to that, you know, it's probably not. I wouldn't do it. But then I'm paranoid, and I freely admit that. So, you know.
Well, if you want a good complicated password, you can ask my wife. I mean, she's a master at coming up with these.
Well, one quick tip I would give you on that is if you can think of a phrase, okay, some fairly complex phrase. First off, a phrase is going to be harder to crack because it's not going to be in a dictionary. And then secondarily, if you replace some of the characters with symbols, like, for example, the letter A with the at symbol, you come up with a phrase, and then you replace all the A's with the at symbol. So it's easier to remember because it's a phrase, and if you just use some simple replacements like that, it's not a perfect system, but it will give you the opportunity to create fairly strong passwords and something that's kind of rememberable as opposed to just some random string of characters.
Are there a lot of people out there using their birth dates? I mean, is that a common thing that people are just creating these horrible, weak passwords because they're just doing things that are too common and too easy to think
of?
Yeah,
the latest big password breaches still see a surprising number of those, and I think 123456 is still the most popular password.
Yep, things like password, using the word password as your password. Yeah. You'd be surprised at what some of the top tens are. They're pretty obvious.
I just want to say one last thing again to what Michael said before. You can't really stress enough, using the same credentials, the same username and password on multiple sites is a recipe for disaster. So they hack your information from Yahoo, and if you've used the same credentials for your bank, well, now they got your money. So I know it's painful. I know nobody wants to hear this, but you really need to use different credentials for every site, platform, whatever you want to call it that you use. Otherwise, you're really just inviting disaster for yourself.
Yeah, that does make it harder to remember, though, when you have it at many places. And that's where some of those password manager tools come in, because they can randomly generate super complex passwords that no one would ever remember, and different ones for every site that you go to. And then you can use those apps, you know, to insert your password every time you log in, so you don't even have to really remember it.
I'm always concerned about that. It'll always ask me if I want the site to remember my username and my password, and that always worries me. How safe is that, actually?
If you're on a computer that only you use, it's relatively safe. If you're out on a public computer or you're at the library or something like that, never share that information or tell it to save
it. Very bad from any public place where someone else can access. You might as well write it down on a piece of paper and hand it to them.
Free Wi-Fi, for example. I mean, what is? Are there risks inherent in free Wi-Fi?
Yes.
Yes. It's quite easy for an attacker to clone a Wi-Fi ID and have you connect to theirs. If they control the Wi-Fi, that means basically they control like name resolution. So, you know, you think you're going to say usbank.com, but you're actually going to, you know, evilhacker.com, and it just looks like US Bank.
How clever are these people, James? It sounds like as you start to figure them out, they come up with some new version of their attacks.
Yeah, they're constantly improving in skill. I mean, the sort of old scams never go away, but they keep coming up with better and better ones. So, you know, instead of the old style phishing where they send out a horribly misspelled email to everybody saying, you know, go to your bank and set your password, now they target people based on research from your social networks or hacked accounts, and it looks very legitimate. It's coming, the hacks come from people that you know. And they tend to have attachments that are things you're expecting, but if you open the attachment, it will silently install their malware and take over your computer.
Yeah, in the enterprise space, we're seeing that phishing emails is really the number one way that some of these attacks start, because it's really easy for them. If they can get somebody on the inside of the network behind the perimeter to connect out to the internet, that's a lot easier than brute forcing breaking your way into the company. So,
what exactly is phishing, Michael?
So phishing is when they'll send an email that looks like it's intended for you. It'll try to harvest some information from you or send you to a place, get you to click on something that will drop something malicious on your box and grant somebody on the outside access. So for example, one of the things that we see a lot of is something will go to an accounts receivable department at a company. It'll say that your account is past due and your invoice needs to be paid. And you'll look down and you'll see your company logo. You'll see a supplier that you do business with. And you'll think, oh, no, I better get back to them because I've got an invoice. And you'll click on the attachment to go look at the invoice. And the attachment will say something like, hey, let's enable macros. And when you enable macros on Microsoft Word, there'll be a program that you're just allowing to run by clicking on that. And it'll open up a back door, connect back
That's
to the internet.
That's their way in.
And it'll download additional stuff that will then compromise your system and deliver ransomware or whatever malicious program that they're trying to deliver.
Well, I'll tell you a real-world specific story. So a variant of phishing is spear phishing, and a variant of that is whaling, where they target high-level executives to basically say, hey, this is the CEO of your company because you're some person way down in the hierarchy, and you need to do a wire transfer. So here's a real-world story. As you know, I'm the mayor of Fort Wright. I got a call from our city clerk who said, Dave, did you email me and ask me to do a wire transfer? Now, this is a city in northern Kentucky of 6,000 people, okay? Not some major corporation. I mean, it shows that this happens at all levels. She literally got two emails, one that asked for the account balance in our checking account, and a second one instructing her to set up two wire transfers, one international. Like, why would we ever do something like that? And thankfully, she had the good sense to call me and say, hey, Dave, is this for real? And I'm like, no, it's not. So stop doing whatever you're doing and call our IT people and have them come check out your system because this is bad.
So is that the best defense against this? Because some of this sounds really convincing and clever and easy to fall for. Is it just be skeptical and if it doesn't seem quite right, like,
well, that's
a question
simple,
it?
Simple two-factor phone call that she made. You know, hey, if you get a request for that, things like ACH wire transfers mm-hmm. at a company, you always should have two steps to validate, that it is okay. Don't just go ahead and send it.
Yeah, I would say anytime, anything what might seem even remotely unusual, you should probably question it, because I think one of the things that these folks prey on is average people don't really understand they could be targeted like this. And consequently, if you're like an accounting clerk at Procter & Gamble and it looks like the CEO just sent you an email, are you going to question that? Well, I would hope that you would, but clearly some people don't. So I think a healthy dose of skepticism in general, and also just trying to be educated and aware that these kind of things are even possible.
Yeah, look at who those emails are coming from. Oftentimes there are clues that the users can see is, the email address may be something similar, but it's not exactly the same. So maybe a 1 is exchanged for the L in a letter or a word. There may be links where it says click here to claim your whatever, claim your reward. If you scroll over that link, you can see what the actual link is, and it probably will not be the place you expect to be going to. So if it says, hey, come here to reset your password for bank.com, if you scroll over it, it may not be bank.com. It's going to try to take you somewhere that looks like bank.com. It'll ask for your credentials, and you'll type in your username and password, and boom, you just gave it to somebody else, and now they're logging into your real bank.
Some of the other strategies they use, I've heard sniffing. What's sniffing, James?
Yeah, so sniffing is when a hacker takes a look at all of the data flowing on the network. It's very easy to do in a wireless domain since you just set up an antenna and the packets come by. In a wired network, they would have to take control of a machine inside your network to be in sniffing. But once they do that, they see all the traffic going by, and if it's not encrypted, then they can collect passwords or whatever other confidential data you have. Really, encryption is your best defense against sniffing.
Okay, but sniffing is like they take a broad look at what's flowing through, and then they pick and choose what strikes them as being an easy target. How that's working?
Right,
like tapping your phone.
You can literally just suck everything out and then deal with it later.
Hmm. Then there's the other cross-site scripting. What does that involve?
So cross-site scripting is a way an attacker can target a single person. So again, it usually starts with a phishing email or instant message and a link. But the link has encoded in it a program usually written in JavaScript. And so if you click on the link, it will take you to the website. And if you're already logged in to, say, your bank, it will just run that little program to, say, transfer money out of your account. Or if you're logging into a shopping site to automatically purchase something and things like that. They can also use it to persistently take over your browser and watch your entire browser session until you do log into your bank or whatever they're targeting.
I have a friend who has a motto, and she says, don't click on the expletive link. She says, if you're suspicious of it, just never, ever click on that link, because like you were saying, Michael, once you click and you get into it, you're in trouble at that point.
Yeah, it's always a good idea. Yeah, if you do get an email that says it's from your bank or something, you know, go type in the URL yourself or use a bookmark that you created that goes to your bank.
Yeah, if you initiate the transaction, that's what I always try to tell people. If you get some kind of email or whatever, text, whatever, usually if it's got any kind of urgent nature, you must do this or the FBI is going to arrest you or any of these sort of ridiculous things that go out, you know, most of the time the government is not going to communicate with you that way, nor is any credible business. If you have any doubt at all, though, initiate the transaction yourself. As James said, you go to their website. Don't click the link in the email or text or whatever, or pick up the phone and say, hey, I got an email that purports to be from you. Is this real? What should I do? Because also you're doing them a favor and notifying them that someone is potentially, you know, perpetrating some kind of attack, and then they can potentially notify their other members, whoever that might be. So, you know, you're doing yourself and everyone else a favor if you initiate the transaction and then ultimately let them know that there's some kind of suspicious activity.
How good are firewalls at protecting against this kind of thing?
Unfortunately, not very, very good, since email and such has to get through the firewall, and the person who receives the phishing email clicks on it and initiates an outbound connection, which is typically allowed to and has to be allowed for normal business activities to take place. So firewalls are basically a way of eliminating certain types of attacks, but that's sort of forced the hackers to get into the phishing type attacks.
Yeah, they help block out a lot of the noise, but they're static. They don't really change. So when you look at what we're actually trying to prevent and protect ourselves against, it's people on the other end of this. So these people know that you've got a firewall. They know what's being blocked, and therefore they know how to get around it, and they'll find a way around it, and that's what they're doing now.
They'll figure a way to climb over that wall, won't they?
Absolutely.
We've had hacking politicians. That's been in the news a lot lately. There's even been stories about voting systems being vulnerable to hacking. So for advocates of more online activity, such as voting, what's the message here?
Don't.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
We've got to get out and vote.
we're nowhere close to a point in time where the systems are secure enough to do this without potential disaster.
Yeah. Sometimes I get asked by students, like, well, we can bank online, so why can't we vote online? But they're really different problems. You know, with banking, you want to be authenticated. You want your bank to know who you are, but voting is a secret ballot. Banking, you can do every day. Voting is a one-day event. And recently we've seen some massive denial of service attacks. Journalist Brian Krebs was hit by 650 gigabits per second of traffic, so much that one of the world's premier content delivery networks, Akamai, said they can no longer handle his site. And that's basically because he published some stories that pissed off some hackers, though they just decided to take him off the internet. And if that's what some pissed off hackers can do, imagine what, you know, state level actors could do on election day. It'd be very easy for so many groups to shut down the election entirely for the whole day.
Yeah, so even if you couldn't necessarily hack the votes themselves, because a lot of the voting systems are essentially air-gapped while they're doing their thing. Air-gapped means it's not connected to anything, right? But at some point, that's all got to get tallied up, and you know the totals have to be done. Even if you can't get to that, to James's point, you could potentially shut down the systems with overwhelming amounts of traffic specifically directed at it such that people couldn't vote. That would be bad.
Yeah, and especially if they're state-level systems, it costs a lot of money to get to buy DDoS protection. And even if you have it, as the big attack on Brian Krebs last week showed, it might not be enough.
So back to the individual level, other advice for protecting yourself online?
I think, again, I'll go back to what I said before. You need to have a healthy dose of skepticism and understand that there are bad people out there, and they're after you all the time. And I think a lot of people don't really understand how automated much of this is. You know, this isn't necessarily some dude in his mom's basement spending all night long trying to hack into your account. You can go online and look up hacker tools, download all kinds of software. You know, even on a small scale like one person, much of it can be automated. But as James mentioned, on a state level where you have like an actual government, some kind of espionage type thing going on, much of this is automated, and they're attacking anything and everything they can find. While certainly a lot of it's targeted, a lot of it's just, if I can find something open out there, I'll see what I can get out of it.
I think you just got to look at the internet's a bad neighborhood, so you got to be smart.
I keep thinking Wild Wild West when you say that.
Yeah, it's a bad neighborhood, so you're gonna run into bad things out there, and you got to know that. Yeah, there's some common sense things you got to do, and when you're not using it and you're not out and doing anything, then turn your system off, because there are things out there that, you know, that hit people that aren't really specifically targeting them. It's just they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, just like what happens in a bad neighborhood, right? So I think there's some common sense things to do, and stay off the line when you're not using it, and change your passwords and get some of the basic things that are really not that hard to do.
Yeah, to summarize what Stacey said, yes, certainly be skeptical. You should initiate connections rather than clicking on links or using phone numbers and communications you receive. Use two-factor authentication. Passwords, really, I'd say 12 is the absolute minimum length today, and really you should go longer than that.
So, James, tell us about the events that are coming up. We have the Northern Kentucky Forum that's coming up on October the 20th called You've Been Hacked. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Right. So this is an event. It'll be held on NKU's campus in the Griffin Hall Digitorium next Thursday night. And it's aimed at the broader community. So we're going to be talking about these individual level problems, who's attacking you, what you can do about it. A couple of my students will give some demos. One will use some tools to show how different websites are surveilling you as you go from site to site as you're surfing the web. And another will actually demonstrate a phishing attack. So we'll show you how easy it is to clone a legitimate website, set it up so that the credentials go to the hacker, and show how you craft a phishing email. And we'll show what happens when, as a victim, you click on the phishing email and go to their site.
And then the 9th Annual NKU Cybersecurity Symposium, that is Friday, October 21st.
Yes, so next Friday at the Northern Kentucky Convention Center, we'll be having our annual security symposium. We've got multiple tracks of events ranging from, you know, the very technical forensics and software security, but we've also got security governance and policy, healthcare, and a legal issues track as well.
And you can find links to more information about both events at WVXU.org. James, Michael, and Dave, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Northern Kentucky University College of Informatics Associate Professor Dr. James Walden, Michael Picton, co-founder and vice president of Managed Detection and Response Services at Morphic, and software architect and developer Dave Hatter. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Belinda Kai. Dave Shermer was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney. Each Friday on Cincinnati Edition, local editors and reporters join us for a look at the events affecting our region. This week, we'll get an update on the continuing heroin crisis and efforts by local individuals and organizations to fight the epidemic. And with less than 4 weeks to Election Day, we'll hear how the presidential race is playing out in Ohio. It's our weekly news review on the next Cincinnati Edition, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.